With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick. that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Hey everyone, have you ever wondered about the official narrative of certain famous crime stories? Did you ever suspect the public wasn't getting the whole truth? If I mention the name Charles Manson, I bet the first words that come to mind are Helter Skelter, the motive used to convict Manson and his cult of the murder of 10 innocent people, including actress Sharon Tate. But what if there was more to this story? What was Helter Skelter? Was it really the reason that the murders were committed? In her true crime book, The Manson Family, More to the Story, author H. Allegra Lansing has laid out a chronology of the Manson family history that gives a more transparent understanding of why the killings happened and what we can still learn from these events all these years later. The Manson Family, More to the Story is available on Kindle, Nook, and in paperback through Amazon, or you can listen to the audiobook by visiting mansonfamily.net. It's the summer of 2009, and Toni Sharpless, a 29-year-old single mother, has been working hard. Not only has she been busy raising her 12-year-old daughter, but she spent several years first putting herself through nursing school and then working as a nurse at Lancaster Hospital's infectious disease ward. So on the night of August 23rd, when her old friend Crystal Johns offers her a night out in Philadelphia, the normally low-key Toni said yes. She and Crystal set off with the intention of dancing and having a good time, but after ending up at the home of a professional basketball player, things went very wrong for Toni, and she hasn't been seen to this day. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Toni Lee Sharpless. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Toni Lee Sharpless was born on December 27, 1979, to Donna Sharpless in Dowington, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. When she was six, Toni's father died in a car accident. Her mother remarried, though, and her new husband, Peter Nebel, raised Toni and her sister Candy as his own daughters. After that, Toni seemed to have a pretty standard suburban childhood, but while she was in high school, she became pregnant. According to her mother, Donna, Toni took the unexpected pregnancy in stride. She says in an episode of Disappeared about her daughter's disappearance that she never had the, are you too young for this, conversation with Toni. Toni just told her she wanted to have her baby, and that's what she did. Though she was young, Toni was very serious about motherhood and loved raising her daughter. But 2 years later, when she was 19, Donna says that things began to change with Toni. She said that her daughter would call her and say that she couldn't stop crying. And these weren't just her average, I'm hormonal and a mother of a toddler and I'm overwhelmed crying jags, which, you know, I am very familiar with. Donna said these would last up to 3 days.
Wow. So, I mean, that sounds like potential clinical depression.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely goes beyond your garden variety. Like I said, kind of hormonal, you know, feelings of being overwhelmed and things like that that always accompany having a toddler.
Yeah.
Yeah, 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like deeper depression.
Right. And Toni and her family immediately realized this obviously was not good, so Toni was hospitalized. But unfortunately, doctors had a difficult time diagnosing her, which, you know, you often see in situations like this. So they couldn't get the right medication, and Toni ended up hospitalized several more times over the next couple of years. During this time, she also used alcohol to self-medicate, which, as you can imagine, did not go well.
So who's got the baby at that point when she's going in and out of the hospital?
So from what I understand, when she wasn't in the hospital, she had the baby, but her parents were very involved. And so I'm pretty sure that her parents had the baby when she wasn't able to care for her.
Gotcha.
Yeah, nothing is really said in anything that I read about her child's father. So I just don't think he was really in the picture much at all. Toni had a big scare when she had apparently been drinking and totaled her car. Now, I mean, that's awful regardless, but, you know, and she's so lucky that she didn't hurt herself or someone else, but it's also terrifying considering that her father died in a car accident.
Right. Yeah.
And her mother does say that that experience led Toni to get her life back on track. So, but, you know, it wasn't just like that happened and everything was fine because she still had a mental illness. You can't just, you know, think your way out of that.
Yeah, I mean, hitting rock bottom and dealing with one potential issue with the drinking or yeah. the self-medicating, that's great. I mean, that's not great.
Well, dealing with it is great.
Dealing with it is great, yeah. But if you don't treat the underlying issues, you're just going to repeat the same behaviors and find another way to medicate, whether it's not alcohol, whether it's something else.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And so, but luckily it does sound like everything kind of started getting better. So after that, you know, Toni was hospitalized again, but at that point she finally received a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And, you know, she was prescribed medication for that. That did seem to help. So up to that point, she had been working weekends as a nursing assistant at a local rehab center. But once she was on these new meds and once she had her diagnosis, you know, it seems like she was just feeling a little bit more stable. So she decided to go to nursing school. And in order to do that, Toni and her daughter moved in with her parents. And she earned her degree in 2007.
Good for her.
Yeah. And shortly thereafter, she started working full-time at Lancaster General Hospital. And it sounds like when Toni was on her medications and focused, like, she could basically do anything. She was smart. She was determined. I mean, you know, again, she was a single mom. And, yeah, she obviously had a very loving and supporting family, which is amazing. But it's still hard to be a single mother. And she put herself through nursing school and had a very demanding job at a hospital.
Yeah, and even if you're on, you know, good medication mm-hmm. for bipolar disorder, it's still very difficult to kind of regulate your moods.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, when you're down, I mean, even with the meds, mm-hmm. you're really down.
Yeah.
So.
And Toni definitely did continue to experience issues. In 2008, she was actually arrested for a DUI. And in March of 2009, her bipolar disorder was leading her to experience severe manic states, and she relapsed again. So this time, Toni just asked her family to take her to rehab. Because, you know, she knew. Like, she knew that she just couldn't continue the way she was. And that is the thing with, you know, with medications like this is they don't necessarily work forever. And you often have to adjust dosage. Like, right. Sometimes you have to try different combinations.
Yeah,
it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all thing.
No, not at all.
So after spending a month in rehab, Toni was put on a new combination of medication to control her bipolar disorder, and she was doing better than she had been doing in a long time. Toni's sister Candy says in that episode of Disappeared that I mentioned earlier that, you know, Toni wasn't supposed to drink on that medication. But, you know, Toni had been a drinker, and not just for self-medicating, just like in general for fun or, you know, just socially.
Not a whole lot to do in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So.
Yeah. So, but Candy, her sister,
take it from somebody that you know grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. Yeah. You know, there's a reason why Live wrote a song called Shit Town. So.
Well, exactly. And so, you know, drinking was just generally a part of her life, aside from, you know, any bipolar issues or whatever other issues she had. But Candy, her sister, was really supportive of her and wanted to see Tony do well. So she would, you know, really try to come up with things for them to do that, like, didn't involve drinking and, you know, just try to help her out in that way.
Yeah.
On August 22, 2009, Tony had just gotten off of working the night shift at the hospital. Now, this is where the story gets crazy to me, and this is not at all even the crazy part of the story. So we should tell our listeners what you know, which is that I am the worst person in the world when it comes to sleep.
That is very true. Very
I am neither a morning person nor a night owl.
No, and you do not sleep through the night.
I don't sleep through the night, and I cannot wake up in the morning, like, at all, ever.
Yeah, no, it's great having a bunch of kids dealing with that schedule.
Okay, in my defense, like, you were gone by 5:30 this morning, and then I was here with all the kids.
That is not true of every morning, though.
No, you're right. But we're on pandemic time, and whatever.
There are no rules.
Yeah, so as you know, anyone who stays up super late or wakes up super early on a regular basis is, like, completely baffling to me. I cannot understand either thing. I don't understand why anybody would ever do that or how or anything. Like, I literally just don't have the brain power to understand that.
You just get into a pattern of doing it. Your body adapts.
Well,
exactly. It's not great. It's definitely not healthy for you, but, you know.
So what you're saying is just I'm just, like, a healthier, better person than everyone else.
No, because you just don't sleep. That's not healthy at all.
Okay, well, but I do want to talk about this because, you know, you have worked the night shift, like Tony,
yes,
over, like, many times over the course of your career.
Yes.
So this is what I want you to do. I want you to go back to when you were in your 20s and working midnights. Let's say you get off at 7 a.m.,
mm-hmm,
and you don't have to go back into work that night. So it's like your day off the next day.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So can you walk us through a typical day? So you get off of work at 7 and then what?
So if I get off of work at 7 and I don't have to be back that night,
mm-hmm,
so I've got a day or two off.
Yeah, we'll just say a day or two.
You know, you either go to sleep right away for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm. No, like, what's a couple of hours?
Like, 2 or 3. Just to get that edge off.
Okay.
Or you just force yourself to stay awake, which I did very often.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, if you've got a couple of days off or even a day off,
yeah,
you want to get back onto, like,
a nighttime schedule?
No, like a normal schedule. So that,
right,
you can,
well,
do
I, well, that's
things,
what I mean, like, sleeping at nighttime.
Yeah, yeah, because you want to do things, you know, during the daylight hours with your friends. So if I got off, mm-hmm, at 7 a.m. and I knew that I had a couple of days off, I'd probably just power through and just stay awake.
Until when?
Till I went to sleep later that night.
Okay, so that sounds awful, first of all.
It's not great.
Yeah, but, like, apparently that's what Tony did. So Tony's mom said that it was typical for Tony not to go to sleep after her shift if she didn't have to work that night.
Yeah.
So, like, she would just power through, like you said, and stay up all day. And that absolutely 100% sounds like my nightmare. I cannot imagine a worse way to live my life.
When you're awake during that time, it's a very weird fog to be in.
Yeah.
Because you're just deliriously tired, but also at the same time excited to not have to go to work
Ugh.
At night.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Toni decided to do that day. After her shift, she went to her sister Candy's house, and Candy had kids, so, like, Candy was awake. Like, she had just woken up because, you know, kids don't sleep in, so everybody was awake at the house. So she went over, and they hung out and, like, sat on the porch and had coffee, and, you know, she played with the kids and things like that. And then they made plans to go shopping that day because, again, like non-drinking activities, keeping Toni busy, stuff right. like that.
Yeah.
So they decided to go shopping all day, and they invited Toni's old friend, Crystal. While they were out, Crystal spoke with her friend, Matt Green, and he invited them all out to basically to clubs in Philly that night.
I see. Then now that's, that's not something I would have done.
Yeah.
When I was working midnight. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Well, for a time you lived in DC, so you wouldn't like go out to DC clubs.
No.
No. I know you're not a club person.
No, not at all.
Yeah. But like the crazy thing is that, so they're in a suburb of Philly, like Philadelphia's like between 45 minutes and an hour away.
So they got invited to go to clubs in Philly.
Yeah, like in Philly.
Wow.
Yeah, and so obviously Candy was like, no, like, that sounds terrible. And she declined. But, you know, to her surprise, Toni said yes. And again, like going to a club after being awake at that point for over 24 hours seems like a terrible punishment to me. But Toni and Crystal were excited and ready for a good time. Crystal's friend Matt, the one who called and invited them out, was the brother of Willie Green, who played for the Philadelphia 76ers. So when they arrived at the G Lounge in Old City, they had quite the night.
I bet.
They went to the VIP section, drank champagne, danced, and mingled with celebrities. Because apparently there's like more than one celebrity in Philadelphia at a time. I don't know. But that's what Crystal said.
I don't know. Are they celebrities from Jersey Shore?
Maybe.
I don't know.
As the night went on, Crystal and Toni were having the time of their lives. Now, at this point, it is important to say that we don't know whether Toni had taken her meds that day. While she was generally good about taking them, she wasn't perfect, so it was possible that she skipped a dose.
And did you say she was drinking?
Yeah.
There's evidence that she was drinking.
So one possibility of, you know, what happened next can be because she skipped her medication. Now, like you said, yes, they were drinking. And the other possibility is that she had taken her medication, which was contraindicated for alcohol.
Right.
And according to Crystal, they didn't just stop at a few glasses of champagne. They were also drinking Grey Goose and pineapple, and the waitresses were bringing around shots. So they were taking shots, they were drinking Grey Goose and pineapple, and so, I mean, champagne, they had a mix of alcohol in their system. And like, all right, side note, this does not matter at all, but if you're mixing an alcohol with a fruit juice, like, it doesn't need to be expensive. Like, I know people like to say they want to drink Goose or whatever, but if you're putting it in pineapple juice, just get something cheaper because it literally makes no difference. Anyway, the club closed at 2, but, you know, they were having one of those nights where they were just dancing and having so much fun, and they did not want the night to end. So when Willie Green invited the group back to his house to continue the party, like, they jumped on it. And this was obviously a bad idea because from what Crystal says, it sounds like they were not in a state in which either of them should have been driving. And they did drive to the club. They had both made the nearly hour-long trip from West Brandywine Township, which is where they lived, to Philadelphia in Toni's car. Willie's home in Gladwine, though, was basically like on their way home. So while they definitely should not have been driving at all, they were at least going in the correct direction. I mean, Gladwine is way, way closer to Philly, though, than Brandywine is. So while they were going in the right direction, like they weren't actually getting very far from where they were. So the party continued at Willie's house, and the group played drinking games, and they even got into the pool. And at this point, you know, Crystal and Toni kind of split up just because they were just both doing different things, enjoying the party. And Crystal was out at the pool. But shortly before 5 a.m., things started to go wrong. Crystal says that somebody came out to get her from the pool and told her that she needs to go get her friend because she was basically going crazy. When a confused Crystal went inside, she saw that Tony was basically just completely freaking out. She was yelling. She was pouring champagne everywhere. She was losing it and like accusing people of making fun of her. And I don't know, just really strange stuff. Some people said she was even using racial slurs. So Willie, who did not know these two women, remember, Crystal was friends with Willie's brother. He basically said they needed to take a hike. Crystal tried to get Tony to let her drive them home, but Tony took the keys and said that it was her car, so she was driving. Other partygoers expressed concern about Crystal getting into the car with Tony, but Crystal said, hey, look, we came together, we leave together.
That's great, but, you know, Tony obviously shouldn't be driving.
Well, exactly. And let's have another safety side note here. If you're out with friends, this is absolutely the philosophy that you should have. If you came together, you leave together. And, you know, in 2009, Uber wasn't a thing. And I can't imagine that getting a cab in a Philadelphia suburb at 5 a.m. wasn't super easy. But now, today, it is 2020. So if you go out and you're partying like this, you need to come together and leave together in an Uber.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no excuse now.
So Tony and Crystal leave, and Crystal is completely embarrassed by the scene that Tony just caused and the fact that they got kicked out of a party at 5 a.m. The two argue in the car and don't make it far, like literally just on the street, before Tony tells Crystal to get out of the car. And Crystal still does not understand what's going on with her friend because, you know, they've known each other for years and she's like never seen Tony act like this before. For some reason, and this part is still crazy to me, she actually gets out of the car. But, you know, she says that she thought like that Tony would just come right back for her. It's 5 a.m. She's in a strange neighborhood. They're about 45 minutes from where they live. And so she thought, okay, yes, Tony's having a moment. She's having a bad time, whatever's happening, but she's not going to just leave me here.
Yeah, well, I mean, this sounds like she's having a bad reaction to a mix of medication and alcohol. I mean, even if she hadn't taken the medication that day, medication like that is, it's, I don't even know what the right word is. It stacks.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it builds up in your system over time, and it becomes more effective. At least that's the theory behind it.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds like she's having a bad manic episode.
Well, exactly, yeah. And so that's what I'm saying.
Mixed with the alcohol.
Yeah, so she's drunk.
Yeah.
And presumably she hasn't been drinking like that in a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. Plus, yeah, she seems to be having a manic episode on top of it. So there's just a lot going on. Crystal waits for her, but, you know, the neighborhood's dark and scary. Like, there aren't a lot of streetlights. It's just a residential neighborhood. And so she eventually heads toward the highway, still thinking that Tony is going to come back any minute and just, like, wants to get to a better lit area to wait for her. So she obviously tries calling Tony on her cell phone, you know, over and over, but never gets any answer. Eventually, Crystal is just kind of pissed and scared and wants to go home. She manages to get in touch with her nephew, who comes and picks her up. Now, at this point, Crystal doesn't think that anything bad has happened to Tony. She thinks she's lucky that something bad didn't happen to her because, you know, she's the one who got left on the side of the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she calls and texts Candy, Tony's sister, to tell her what happened. And when Candy gets up and gets her messages, she's really confused because obviously that's not what anybody expected to happen that night. So she calls their parents' house, but finds out that her sister never made it home.
And what time of day is this?
So this is like sometime in the morning. So, I mean, so Crystal, you know, probably gets picked up between 6-7. So she's like probably texting, you know. Starts texting Candy right around when she's on her way home.
Okay.
And then Candy just gets it whenever she wakes up, which is still probably relatively early because, again, she has kids and, you know, nobody gets to sleep.
No.
The fact that Tony didn't make it home obviously worries the family, but, You know, they also knew that Tony had been up for over 36 hours. So Donna hopes that maybe she just pulled over to get some sleep.
Yeah. Well, and let me tell you from my experience, because I have definitely had those nights into days where I was awake for 36, 37 hours at a time.
Oh, my God.
And I did not even have alcohol or anything. And it was the weirdest state of consciousness I've ever been in.
Yeah.
And it, again.
Yeah. So it's so crazy. I mean, so think about that. Then add alcohol, then add a manic state to it.
Now, look, I mean, if I was in that situation, the first drink I had, especially champagne, because that puts me to sleep when I'm totally sober.
Yeah.
Like I just would have fallen asleep. I would have passed out. I would have found a nice couch to sleep on in whatever club.
I know, right? Because they're in the VIP lounge, so there probably was a nice couch.
Yeah. I would have slept there.
Totally. The problem with this theory, though, of Tony just pulling over somewhere and going to sleep is that the last time anyone heard from her was at 3:30 a.m., well before she left Willie Green's house. Tony's daughter had texted her because she couldn't sleep. And, you know, Tony texted her back and said, "Hey, good night. I'll be home soon. Get some sleep. Love you."
And what time was that text?
3:30.
But I thought you said that they got kicked out of the house party at 5.
They did. Yeah. So this text was like way before they got kicked out and before, you know, she started freaking out and, you know, so this is just like, so the club closed at 2.
Right.
And then they went to Willie's house after that. So this is kind of early on in the party at Willie's house where everything was, you know, presumably going well, where everyone's just hanging out.
So who said that they got kicked out at 5? Like who noticed what time it was?
Crystal did.
Okay.
Yeah.
But she like legitimately saw a clock, looked at her watch, whatever. And...
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if that was like an estimation or something.
No, I mean, you know, give or take a couple of minutes. I'm sure it wasn't 5 o'clock on the dot, but, obviously, yes, but yeah, no, it was right around 5 o'clock. And Crystal said that, Willie said that, like everybody they interviewed said it was around 5 o'clock. So yeah, so the last time though that anybody heard from Tony was that 3:30 a.m. text, and they said that it was completely out of character for Tony to not come home without calling or texting to let them know. So, you know, Donna, her mom, is saying, yeah, she very well could have, you know, pulled over to sleep, but she would have just sent me a text to say, hey, this is what I'm doing. So all day Sunday, Candy, Donna, and Crystal are calling around trying to find out where Tony is. You know, they all knew that if she was just hanging out somewhere, that she would have been in contact. She had a 12-year-old daughter, after all, and Tony never just bugged out. Like, that just wasn't something that she did. You know, she was very close with her family, and they were always in contact. So their first thoughts at that point, when, you know, Sunday morning's going by and she's still not showing up, was that, okay, well, she definitely wasn't taking a nap somewhere. Now they're thinking, oh no, did she get into an accident? Did she get arrested for a DUI? Like, what's going on? So they started calling jails, hospitals, you know, going through the whole thing and nothing. Throughout the day, obviously, the panic is just growing and growing as they don't hear from Tony. So that night, Sunday night, around 9:30, after they still haven't heard from her, Crystal finally calls the cops. Now, if you think it's weird that Crystal is the one who calls the cops and not her mother or sister, like, you're not alone. The police were also like, hey, hi, who are you? And why are you calling us about this lady who you're not related to? But basically, what Crystal said is that, you know, Donna and Candy were still thinking there was a reasonable explanation for all of this, and so they didn't want to jump the gun. Which leads me to another safety side note. And this is something that you and I have talked about before, but I think it's super, super important to mention, which is that women have been ingrained to not inconvenience people. We have been ingrained to not be hysterical. And oftentimes, these societal expectations lead us to ignore our gut, which often gets us hurt. Or in this case, prevents family members from calling the police when they know something is terribly wrong. And if anyone out there has not read The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, I highly, highly recommend it. It talks in great length about this very issue and the negative consequences that women often face because of it.
Yeah, and from a police perspective, that's detrimental to the investigation also.
Yeah, you're losing hours.
Absolutely. You know, it's in a missing persons case, it's crucial to get as much information as you can right up front.
Right.
And start
trying to determine what happened.
Yes.
And we talk about this in the Cindy Song case where, you know, it's kind of the flip side where she was reported missing and the cops like didn't really get going on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that's something you have to potentially contend with, like it is that much more important that as soon as you think something's wrong, like you tell them because you don't want that delay to be on your end.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me make it absolutely clear that I am not blaming Candy or Donna in this, but, you know, they were reticent to get the police involved after Tony, who was clearly in an unsafe condition when she was last seen, you know, she already hadn't been seen for 16 hours at this point. And that's a long time. And if Crystal hadn't called the police at 9:30 that night, how many more hours would have gone by? My safety tip is listen to your gut and don't worry about making a big deal out of nothing because you will much rather just feel kind of dumb, you know, when the person comes strolling back in the house than thinking, oh my God, what would have happened had I done something sooner?
Yeah. I mean, it's also important to note that, you know, if you make a phone call like that to the police and you're concerned about a family member, you're not going to get in trouble.
Right.
I understand that people think that there's, you know, charges that can be brought up if you make a false 911 call.
Oh, but you don't even want me to go down that rabbit hole of false 911 calls and people who don't get charged with that.
Sure. But this is not one of those cases
at all.
You know, if you have genuine concern, tell the police.
Yeah.
You know, call them.
Yeah, and they might blow you off, but, like, at least you've done your part and you've gotten the ball rolling.
Right, and they might not.
Right.
And they might start an investigation.
Right then.
Yeah, and...
And it could make a difference.
Yeah. And like you said, maybe they stroll in an hour after the investigation is going on. Well, guess what? Police conclude their investigation and they move on.
Yeah, everybody goes home. Everybody, like, goes and eats dinner.
Yeah,
we're cool.
And... The cops in that situation, I can guarantee you, are not going to be angry about it.
Right.
Because they're going to be like, well, that's the end of my shift.
Yep.
Let me just fill out this paperwork, finish up this report.
Go home.
Case closed, I go home.
Mm-hmm. So after the report is made, Brandywine police start investigating because that's where Tony lives. But they're quickly joined by Lower Marion police, which is where Tony disappeared. As they question Crystal and Tony's family, they find out that Tony had actually attempted suicide before. So right away, police began to be concerned that that's what happened here.
Right, so now this is a critical missing person case.
Yeah, I mean, she was drinking, she was upset, she was missing. So
history of mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they think maybe she decided to end her life. Tony's family vehemently disagreed with this theory, saying that she had a lot to live for. She had a job that she had worked hard for. She had her daughter whom she loved. And aside from this night, she had been doing really well on her medication and just like in her life in general. They did not believe she was suicidal. And, you know, they could be completely right or not.
Sure, but bipolar disorder.
Right.
It's ups and downs. It's. Even at the best of times, it is not a steady road.
Exactly. And, you know, when I started researching this case, I learned about how Tony had these mental health issues that doctors had trouble identifying. And, you know, it lasted several years and that she turned to alcohol to self-medicate and then was eventually diagnosed as bipolar. It kind of sounded familiar to me. So I called somebody who we both know who has dealt with all of these issues before. And, you know, my main question was to ask him how bipolar medications can interact with alcohol. Because, you know, that's the crux of a lot of the theories surrounding this case. You know, that basically, for one reason or another, that combination led Tony to not be in her right mind. So he said that without knowing what exact medication she was on, which I couldn't find anywhere, it's hard to say because different medications react differently with alcohol. The main issue that you'll run into with a lot of them is that alcohol decreases their efficacy. So if that was the case, it would make sense that Toni went into a manic state because, you know, she was without sleep and alcohol was possibly preventing her medication from working properly. And I didn't tell him, like, much about the case, just that it was about a woman who was diagnosed as bipolar and had last been seen driving away from a party after drinking all night. But as we were talking, he told me about how a lot of problems arise from people with bipolar being given antidepressants. He said that SSRIs often lead to suicidal thoughts with people who have this condition. It happened to him, and it also happened to a friend's son. In the son's case, his mom was driving him somewhere, and he said, "Mom, I just had an urge to kill you and kill myself, and I don't know why."
Jesus.
Yeah. And, you know, he hadn't been feeling homicidal. He hadn't been feeling suicidal at all. It was just this urge that suddenly came on completely out of nowhere. And, you know, the person who I was talking to said that he experienced the same thing. Like, no overt suicidal thoughts, no depression, but just a quick, sudden, intense suicidal urge. So if something like this happened to Toni, that could explain, you know, what happened to her. Maybe she wasn't suicidal in the classical sense in a way that her family would notice, but perhaps the urge just came on so strongly and she couldn't stop it.
Right, a spontaneous suicidal urge.
While we were still on the phone, we were talking about this, about the suicidal urges, he said to me, "You said she was driving? I'd look for her on the bottom of a lake." And when he said that, and again, I mean, I had not told him about this case really at all. When he said that, it sent chills down my spine because while there wasn't a lake involved, there was a river. Toni was in Gladwine, which she was not familiar with. And apparently it's a relatively rural area that isn't lit very well. And as her parents were searching for her in the days after her disappearance and kind of looking at the map, they saw that it would have been very easy for her to miss her exit and end up going toward the Schuylkill River. In fact, they believe that she could have mistakenly driven down a boat ramp and driven straight into the water. So, you know, her parents say that, like, she could have accidentally driven into the water. You know, she also could have easily, if she had the suicidal urge, just driven off the boat ramp straight into the water. So, you know, regardless of the reasoning behind it, I mean, even police agreed that this was...
That was the best location to search.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very likely scenario.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about all this, my thought was, where was the car?
You know, right.
Because that's a good place to start, so...
Well, yeah, exactly.
Car's not there... Yeah. Body of water nearby. It's probably the best place to start.
Mm-hmm. And so they do. You know, they went to the river and they investigated, but they couldn't find any evidence of a car going into the river. So basically they couldn't justify the expense of a river search. And I don't know, like, what evidence you would find of a car going into the river. I don't know, tire tracks, like skid marks.
I mean, you're not going to leave skid marks if you
are just driving.
If you just drive into the river.
Yeah. So I don't know. But luckily, a nonprofit called Texas EquiSearch came up and conducted a search of the river themselves. They were accompanied by Lower Merion police and they used sonar to search the bottom of the river. And after that, it did not take long for them to find a car. Once Texas EquiSearch identified a car at the bottom of the river, then the Philadelphia dive team got involved. Toni was driving a 2002 black Pontiac Grand Prix when she disappeared. But as the search went on, it wasn't just one car that was found at the bottom of the river. It was 11.
11?
11 cars. And not even like... the whole river. We're talking about just this area near the boat ramp.
Is this like Suicide Point?
No. So apparently the remote location of this boat ramp combined with the depth of the water, so it was almost 25 feet deep, like right off of the ramp.
Wow.
Made it a popular place to ditch stolen vehicles.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, with so many cars, it took over a week to identify all of them. And as Tony's sister Candy put it, it was a lose-lose situation for them. If they found Tony's car, then she wasn't alive. But if they didn't, and then they still didn't have any answers. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. None of the cars turned out to be Tony's. At this point, there are basically no clues and no indication of what actually happened to Tony after she left Crystal on the side of the road. So, absent any physical evidence, police naturally turned back to the people who were there that night. So, they re-interviewed Crystal and the Greens. Everyone's story matched up, though, so police were basically at a loss. They had no evidence that a crime had even occurred at that point.
Right, so now we're back into the realm of she's an adult.
Mm-hmm.
She can abandon her family if she wishes.
Right.
So, yes, it might seem very out of character, but it's not illegal, per se.
Well, no, it's certainly not.
They can certainly investigate to an extent, but what level of investigation are they going to do at this point?
Right, when there's literally no physical evidence of anything happening whatsoever.
If they don't have a car,
yeah,
then it just looks like she just drove off.
Right, but since the last place Tony was seen was a professional basketball player's house, the story quickly gained a lot of media attention.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. People immediately started pointing fingers at Crystal. They didn't think that she was telling investigators everything that she knew. I mean, to them, her whole story sounded fishy. Some even went so far as to say that she and the Greens disposed of Tony's body after she died either by accident or murder at the party.
All right. Why?
Well, because you have a famous basketball player with a lot to lose. Let's say some girl like OD'd and, you know, they wanted to cover it up to protect his career. I mean, I definitely read a Harlan Coben novel that had like almost that exact same plot.
Fiction. A novel.
I know. And I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying.
Real.
I know that. I'm just saying that's kind of what the thought was. But Crystal's name was getting dragged through the mud so much that eventually she actually called Lower Merion police and asked to take a polygraph test. And to be clear, police already believed her story, but Crystal just wanted to make it absolutely clear to everyone that she had nothing to hide. And I mean, to me, that's such a gamble. Like, I haven't murdered anyone, but oh, I would...
Polygraphs are all over the place.
Well, exactly.
The results of those could be completely inconclusive.
Well, I know, and that's why
they're not admissible in court.
Yeah. And I would be terrified to take a polygraph, because even though I haven't murdered anyone, like, I would be convinced I would fail.
And that in itself would lead you to failing the polygraph.
Exactly. Because I'd be overthinking it.
Yes.
And I'd be nervous.
You'd be stressed out. Your heart rate would elevate. Mm-hmm. Your pupils would dilate.
And I would look extremely shady.
Yeah. So you would definitely fail a polygraph no matter what they were asking.
Exactly.
You.
So that's why I'm like, oh my goodness, she like called them and volunteered for it.
Good for her.
Well, yeah, the risk paid off because she passed with flying colors. You know, weeks passed with no leads in Tony's case. That is until police receive a call that could be the first possible break in this baffling case. On September 14th, 3 weeks after Tony was last seen, Lower Merion police get a call from the New Jersey State Police. Tony's car was seen in Jersey. An automated license plate reader hit on Tony's car in Camden, New Jersey. Camden is right across the river from Philadelphia, so it makes sense. The problem is, the plate was pinged on September 8th, 6 days prior to this phone call. So apparently what happened is that the license plate reader was in a parked police vehicle. So there wasn't an officer in the car at the time. And so I guess according to police, you know, I don't know much about these license plate readers, but apparently like if they read a license plate and it's in the system for being stolen or being connected to a crime or whatever, some sort of, you know, alarm goes off or they get a notification or whatever. But because there wasn't a police officer in the car at the time, they didn't get that notification when it happened. And they didn't find out until 6 days later that it was connected to this missing persons case in Pennsylvania. While this lead doesn't end up being the big break that the family was hoping for, because, you know, the car's long gone by that point, it does lead to new theories. Camden is known for being a rough city, especially back in 2009. It was known as a place to easily find sex workers and score drugs. People began to theorize that Tony had perhaps driven to Camden in search of drugs, at which point she met with foul play. But Tony's family does not buy that explanation. Her sister Candy said that despite Tony's past drug issues, she would never go to Camden to find drugs. That wasn't something she had done before. And beyond that, the sisters had recently attended a concert in Camden, and Tony could not wait to get out of there because she didn't feel safe. Like, she wanted to have nothing to do with it. So while they do not buy that Tony went to Camden to buy drugs, her family does believe that she could have possibly driven there. Apparently, she would have had to take the Schuylkill Expressway home, and it's really easy to get turned around and end up in Camden. In fact, when I was chatting with the person I mentioned earlier, he said that the exact same thing happened to him when he was trying to visit a friend in a Philadelphia suburb. Like, he literally just got turned around and then all of a sudden was in Camden and it's like, oh God, what do I do? So to me, like, this theory completely makes sense. Tony was upset, she was in an unfamiliar neighborhood, and she was running on zero sleep. So I can absolutely see how she could have accidentally ended up in Camden despite fully intending to go home, or even fully intending to go back and get Crystal for all we know. But what happened to her after that is, of course, up for debate. Eileen Law is the private investigator that Tony's family hired in October after Tony disappeared. She's a super intense and driven woman who admits to becoming obsessed with finding Tony, and she believed that Tony was alive. Law's theory is that Tony ended up in Camden, whether on purpose or by misadventure, and ended up in a sex trafficking ring.
Why does she think that she's in a sex trafficking ring? Okay. Is that just like the default to missing persons cases?
So that
I don't mean to say that lightly, but like,
right.
Why?
Well, and that was my question, because it's like anytime somebody goes missing, it seems
we jump to that conclusion.
Right. And so she did have reasons. So as we mentioned in the Release Your Red episode, first and foremost, sex trafficking is very real and it's a multi-billion dollar industry in the U.S., and New Jersey is one of the nation's hotspots. Law also says that sex traffickers tend to prey on vulnerable women and then take their phone and credit cards so they can't escape or contact friends and family. And not only was Tony in a vulnerable state that night, but she apparently had less than a quarter of a tank of gas. So if she ended up in Camden and then ran out of gas, she certainly would have been in a dangerous situation.
But nobody in Camden knew she was a vulnerable person. You know what I mean?
Like, yes.
Typically, if you're talking about sex trafficking, you're talking about people grooming them to get into sex trafficking.
Exactly. And it's somebody.
It seems very far fetched for me for this person to be having a manic episode, get lost, end up in Camden, New Jersey, mm-hmm. and then, you know, is this Taken, the movie, like,
yeah.
where they like by happenstance stumble across the perfect victim for sex trafficking? That just seems really unlikely,
right? And you know, and it's interesting because when Eileen's talking about this, to me, she's almost contradicting contradicting her own theory, because she talks about how sex traffickers will go to like bus stations and train stations and places like that and kind of look for people there. But to me, that says that they're looking for runaways. They're looking for people who don't have anywhere to go, and they're offering them a solution to their immediate problem. You know, another big sex trafficking group of victims are women who come in from other countries who have their passports confiscated, who say like, oh yeah, you're going to go work at this nail salon, you're going to go work at this massage parlor,
right,
but we're going to hold your passports,
yeah,
and then, you know, get trafficked that way. I can absolutely see how Tony would appear to be a vulnerable person under that definition, you know, if she was out of gas, if she was having a manic episode, if she was just basically a disaster. But 2 seconds of, you know, talking to this woman would, you know, would allow them to find out that, no, she has a family, like she has a job, she has a life very nearby.
Right. There's connections.
Yeah.
That might be too much of a risk for a sex trafficker.
Exactly. And even worst case scenario, let's just say she was going to buy drugs. I mean, it's the same thing. Like, they're not going to say, okay, let me just kidnap this 29-year-old white woman with a family. Like, that's just, it's not what you do. You go for the easy victims. I mean, with, you know, that's a terrible way to put it.
It's easy prey, yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, you have to think with the criminal mindset here at this point.
Yeah, and you're going to take the path of least resistance.
Right.
Crystal helps Eileen put up flyers in Camden. And again, you know, when I originally heard this story years ago, like, I have to admit that I did think that Crystal seemed a little shady in this whole situation. But, I mean, not only, like we said, she volunteered to take the polygraph, but after her name was cleared and she could have just gone on with her life, she didn't. She helped Eileen, the PI, try to find her friend. Like, she went to Camden and put up flyers with her.
Right. If you are guilty of something and you've essentially been cleared by law enforcement, you don't stay in the spotlight.
Yeah, and she did. Like, she just kept on helping because she wanted to find her friend. You know, and as they were doing that, Eileen's theory does begin to take hold a little bit, because sightings of Tony are reported in Camden. Nothing comes of them, but then when those sightings stop, there are sightings in Lancaster. And then nothing comes of those, but then they stop and sightings start coming out of Delaware. So Eileen, at this point, is convinced that Tony was with someone or a group of someone who was moving her around. Because it would be like a cluster of sightings, and then it would stop, and then it would move somewhere else, and then stop, and then move somewhere else. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to answer that. Like, you know, maybe she is right, but maybe also flyers went up in those particular places. And anytime, you know, there's publicity in a certain place, you know, people are going to have sightings. I don't know.
I don't know either. Yeah. I mean.
But it is interesting. And Crystal apparently did agree with Eileen that something like that happened to Tony. But Tony's family is unsure. I mean, for them, it's like the car in the river. It's a lose-lose. Either Tony is dead, or she was forced into sex trafficking and could very well be dead now.
But if you're a sex trafficker, would you keep them in the same place?
Well, no, but they were moving, right? Like, they were moving from Camden to Lancaster to Delaware.
That's all relatively close area, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're not talking about pulling somebody into sex trafficking in Philly or outside of Philly or Jersey or whatever, and then, you know, moving them across country where these flyers wouldn't be.
Okay, you know? But if we're talking like a low-grade sex trafficker, like some dude who would find a lady on the side of the road in Camden, New Jersey at 5 a.m., like, they probably don't have the resources or the need or desire to go across the country.
True. Fair enough.
Over the years, there continued to be periodic sightings of Tony, but none that ever pan out, and her case grows cold. That is until Eileen receives a shocking letter in December of 2012 from someone who said that they knew what happened to Tony. All right, hon, so I'm going to actually have you read this letter. And this is verbatim, like spelling mistakes and all. And, you know, right now you are hearing everything about this case for the first time.
As with every case, yes. Yeah,
except when I asked for your Pennsylvania expertise in pronouncing Schuylkill. Schuylkill.
Which I did not pronounce correctly.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we'll hear about it, but like the episode of Disappear definitely says Schuylkill. But you didn't even know there was a letter in this case until just now, right?
No.
Okay. So I want you to read it to our listeners and then like we'll chat about it. So here you go.
Dear Eileen Law, the police in PA do not have a tip line. Well, that's not true.
Okay, we'll discuss after. Oh, okay. Just read the letter.
Okay, all right, sorry. I'll start over again. Dear Eileen Law, the police in PA do not have a tip line. I tried calling the Philly police where I live, but they said it was not their jurisdiction. One of the detectives pulled me aside and gave me your name and address. In the last few days of September 2009... a friend in Camden called me and offered me money to move a car from Brooklawn, New Jersey to Boston, Massachusetts. He told me he would pay me $5,000 cash, plus I could have the plates. He asked if I knew anyone 27 or 29 that wanted to paper trip, so he gave me a social security card. I drove the car, a black four-door Pontiac Grand Prix, and drove to a auto body shop outside of Boston, Mass. I took off the plates and with a black magic marker wrote down the last five digits of the VIN number and cleared out the glove box. I came back to Camden a day later and he told me that the car was not stolen but missing. He said a friend of his, a cop in Camden, got into a fight with a girl. She died and he needed to get the car out of Jersey. About a month ago, my daughter was playing in the garage and found the box with the plates and SS card. I had forgotten all about it. The plates are DND7772 and the SS card, parentheses, sharpless, cell phone number was written here, in parentheses, and the last five digits of the VIN are, parentheses, the last five numbers of Sharpless vehicle's identification number was written here in parentheses. Because of Hurricane Sandy, I had to visit Jersey to help friends clean up. I decided to drop you this letter. What happened to Tony, I don't really know. All I know is that she had a run-in with the police, and I was paid much-needed cash to get the car to a shop in Boston.
Okay.
That was a very difficult letter to read.
It's not the best written letter that I've ever read, but there's a lot to unpack.
Yes.
To be clear, the letter writer is saying that his buddy knew a Camden police officer who got into a fight with Tony, killed her, and then the buddy paid him to drive Tony's car from Brooklawn, New Jersey, which is about 5 minutes from Camden, to Boston, Massachusetts, which is about 300 miles away. In return, the unidentified letter writer was given $5,000 and was allowed to keep the license plate and Tony's social security card, presumably so he could sell them later to somebody who had stolen a vehicle, who wanted to have a new identity, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so what I find interesting about this is that he apparently never sold the license plates or social security card and just instead took the $5,000 and threw Tony's stuff in the garage where he forgot about it for almost 4 years.
Right.
So then his daughter finds it and his conscience gets the best of them and he writes this letter to Eileen. But instead of sending the license plate and or social security card, he just writes the numbers down.
Where'd he get Eileen's contact information?
He said that the detective at the Philadelphia Police Department pulled him aside and gave him Eileen's contact info.
Bullshit.
Yeah, because this is after he said that police and PA do not have a tip line.
Bullshit.
Right, and that he called the Philly police where he lives, and they said it was not their jurisdiction.
Bullshit.
Well,
they're not.
You don't think so?
Even if it's not their jurisdiction, they're not. Yeah. They're not going to blow that off.
Well, yeah, and then if you're calling and they are blowing you off, how is a detective pulling you aside to give you the PI's contact info?
Thank you. If a detective's involved, they're going to question this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not their jurisdiction, even if it's not their case, like, they're not going to be like, oh, here's this private investigator I know that's working on the case.
Yeah, like, at the very least, wouldn't they just direct him to the Lower Merion Police Department?
Yes. Exactly. They're not going to be like, hey, this PI is involved in this case.
Yeah.
They're either going to question them, that person themselves, at the very least for their own edification. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, you know, these are career detectives.
Right.
Or they're,
well, yeah, not necessarily, because, well, I guess, no, he did say a detective.
A detective, yes.
Yeah, you're right.
Or they're going to, yeah, like you said, here's the jurisdiction, here's the number you need to call.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to refer you to a PI.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's get back to the substance of what he was saying, right, though. The license plate number that he gave in the letter was correct, but that was also on all of our missing flyers and the news, right, whatever. So they
made public.
Exactly. So that really doesn't matter. But more interestingly, the partial VIN was correct. And that had not been publicized. And neither had Tony's cell phone number, which the anonymous letter writer wrote instead of her social security number. So in that part where he's like, oh yeah, I have a social security card, here's the number, he didn't write a social security number, he wrote Tony's cell phone number.
Hmm.
Which is weird.
Not a sure killer.
I think it is weird. I don't know. I think it is weird. To me,
how would you have that info?
Well, exactly. To me, it seems like this guy was being told some information. Like, I don't know. I don't buy his story, but he does have information that he shouldn't have. The whole Camden police officer killing her thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Bullshit. Why?
Okay, well, I'll tell you. Are you ready for a tinfoil hat time?
Go for it.
Okay, because I'm ready. So, like, let's explore the basic idea that Tony was killed by a police officer.
Okay.
We know that Tony was driving under the influence. We know that she was probably driving erratically. It's not unreasonable to think that she could have gotten stopped for a DUI or even had an accident. And if she was stopped by a bad cop, maybe things went wrong.
Okay. What year is this?
2009.
Okay. Radio runs.
Okay. No. Okay. So.
Body cam.
Oh, body cams.
Dash
we
cam.
Live near Baltimore. You're going to talk to me about body cams?
They have dash cams.
Yes.
There are radio runs. Like, there's no way that this cop is pulling somebody over and not calling in that he's pulling somebody over.
Well, funny you should mention that, because you may not be familiar with this case. In 2015, Daniel Holtzclaw, who was a police officer from the Oklahoma City Police Department, was sentenced to 263 years in prison for multiple crimes, including rape, sexual battery, and forcible oral sodomy, and more, involving 8 women. So what he would do is he would pull over women. And he would do a radio run or whatever you call it. Like, he would do a check on them, basically, to see if they had any, I guess, warrants or outstanding.
Warrants or warrants, yeah.
Ticket. Yeah, exactly. And so if they did, he would use that information to coerce them into having sex with him. And then in 2017, 2 former New York City police officers were sentenced to 5 years of probation after raping a handcuffed 18-year-old woman that they had arrested. They received such a light sentence because at the time it was legal for police officers to, quote, have sex with someone who was under arrest.
What?
Oh, yeah. In fact, at the time, it was legal to do so in 35 states. Now, in 2020, it's legal to do so in 34 states because after this case and these cops basically received no punishment, New York changed their law. So my point is not that this is what happened, but that it's not completely unprecedented. And, you know, I do not at all believe this letter is 100% true. There are just too many logical holes to it. Like, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do kind of believe that it was written by somebody who does know something, who maybe was involved in some way. And maybe they do know what happened to Tony on August 23rd, 2009. And maybe it was that, maybe it was something similar, maybe it involved different people, maybe whatever. But I don't think it's a complete hoax.
I mean, I agree with you. I don't think it's a complete hoax because there is information in there that he shouldn't have known, the letter writer.
Right.
But
that wouldn't, in fairness, be impossible to figure out. So the VIN number, for instance, was not publicly released anywhere. And, you know, but apparently, like, there are ways to find VIN numbers. If you have the license plate number, you know, you can look it up. You can do whatever, I guess. I don't know. But apparently there are places online where you can find VIN numbers based on license plates.
Cell phone number, though.
Yeah. So that's one thing that nobody does have a really good explanation for.
Unless this guy had it.
Right. And then he knew Tony in some way.
And he's guilt-letting.
Yeah.
He's trying to ease his guilt.
Right.
By putting this false letter out.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I do, like, I just do think that there is some truth to it. But do you want to tighten the tinfoil hat a little bit more?
Oh, boy. Go for it.
Okay. So around the same time Eileen received this letter, police received a few weird phone calls. One was from a man claiming to be from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which is Canada's CIA. And he said that Tony's car and a woman fitting Tony's description had been found on the property of their Toronto office. So police, you know, called the Toronto office and was like, oh, hey, by the way, like, do you have our missing person? And they were like, yeah, we have no idea what you're talking about. And then soon after that, somebody else called who claimed to be a sheriff's deputy in South Dakota, and they said that they had Tony's car. But the name he gave didn't exist. And, you know, they called the sheriff's department in South Dakota, and again, they had no idea what they were talking about. And police actually determined that the same man made both calls.
In cases like this, this is actually pretty common.
Yeah.
Well, in any case that gets any kind of publicity, you're going to have these callers that are mental health consumers that call and spout off things and lead police in wrong directions.
Right. But what I find interesting is that these calls came in almost four years after Tony's disappearance when nobody was talking about her case at all.
But maybe they stumbled across it on the internet.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm just saying it's not like at the beginning of an investigation when, you know, they have the hotline and everybody's covering it all the time and you do get all the crank calls. Like, this is just straight 4 years later when it had been crickets. And then you get this letter and then these calls kind of really close together. Mm. So back to the tinfoil hat, right?
Here we go.
So what if we go back to the letter and parts of it are true? Could someone have made those two calls with the express purpose of muddying the waters to make police think that they were all hoaxes? Okay, you roll your eyes at me, but, like, I think that could be possible.
What criminal mastermind do you think we're dealing with here?
What if the person who wrote the letter wasn't the killer, but did dispose of the car or was otherwise involved? And, you know, they had the letter and it came out and the person who was the killer didn't, whether it was a police officer or not, didn't want police to take this letter seriously, didn't want them to investigate it, didn't want them to go further. And so he made these calls just so that they would think it was a rash of hoaxes.
I think you're going down the rabbit hole.
Okay, yes, I am. I've been, you know, it's been a really busy week at work, and I've been writing a lot, and maybe I am going down the rabbit hole.
I think you are.
Okay.
I think you're going a little bit too deep into the conspiracy theories.
Okay, that could be true. I will give you that. But, you know, either way, whether that was the intent or if it was just a coincidence, you know, it worked because the police have written off the letter, basically. Like, you know,
yeah, they just that's what I was saying is yeah. The unfortunate thing about cases like this is you get things like that, you have to investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes time away from you know, where the case should be going, where investigators should be going, even if it's 4 or 5 years later, if it's considered a cold case. You know, it's not like just because it's considered a cold case, if it's 4 or 5 years, if the same detectives are still working, that's still sitting on their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like it's in a box on a shelf and nobody's looking at it now.
Yeah.
You know, so it detracts from the case when you get things like that, unfortunately. And I'm not saying anybody, you know, out there that thinks that they have a valid tip shouldn't call in. By
oh, for
all
sure.
means,
yeah.
absolutely.
But that's
do.
Very different from like saying that you're a sheriff's deputy in
yes.
North Dakota when
or,
you're not,
or like
Canadian CIA,
Canadian CIA, which I don't actually think exists.
It does exist. No, that
sure
is a real
not,
thing.
You're sure it's not just a branch of the RCMP? Because I feel like all law enforcement up there is RCMP.
Yeah, I don't know, but no, it's real. So like that part of it's real, but none of the other parts of it were real. And today, no trace remains of Toni Sharpless. Her daughter has grown up without her mother, but has blossomed into a fun, intelligent woman and an avid dancer. PI Eileen Law has become close to her and has even attended some of her dance recitals. She told Mainline today, quote, "I shouldn't be sitting in that seat. It should be her mom. It pains me to know that her mom isn't there. I've come to love them like my own family, and I want closure for all of us," end quote. Toni's mom, Donna, is a little more circumspect about the idea of closure. She told the Philadelphia Inquirer, quote, "I never understood when people would say I need closure, but I do now. It's like a big, dark hole in my life, and there's no end." Sharpless has been missing since August 23rd, 2009. Toni was driving a black 2002 Pontiac Grand Prix with tinted windows and a PA license plate, DND7772. If you have any information about her car, her current whereabouts, or what may have happened to her that night, you can leave an anonymous tip by going to missingtonysharpless.com. You can see all of the sources for this episode in our show notes and on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why my Lowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only, 5/8 through 5/14. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.